This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. By the fall of 1941, war and genocide had devastated Europe. A Nazi massacre in the Ukrainian city of Ravno killed more than 15,000 Jewish residents in just 2 days. Ravno was a cultural pearl of the region, a place filled with musicians, writers, and artists. But most of the Jewish population was wiped out in an instant, and little was left to document their lives. So a local author is trying to fill the gap. Scott Blumenthal conducted in-depth research and interviews with survivors, and his new novel, The Kiss, recreates the city of Ravno as a backdrop for the story of a young Jewish musician with a magical gift. Scott Blumenthal joins us to talk about his debut novel, which won the Ippy Gold Medal for Historical Fiction. Congratulations and welcome, Scott.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, so tell us about the premise of this novel.
Well, it's a story of three extraordinary musicians who are forced to play during a massacre of their city. They're musicians who have a special gift to awaken the deepest joys and greatest joys and the sweetest memories of their listeners, and they affect each listener in his or her own way.
And so this is a gift, obviously, they were born with, that they had developed by now, and you can assume had never expected to use in this particular context.
Exactly. And like all of us, I like to think, who have something to give to the world, a gift in some way, have something that we may or may not know about that is ready to be discovered and ready to be developed and can possibly do amazing things. And so these three musicians found that gift and were able to find one another and share this gift with the world and affect the world.
You have written a novel. It is fiction, mm-hmm. by definition. But Ravno is not. And what happened there was, in fact, a true story. How did you find out about it and what got you interested in Ravno?
It's interesting because I did lots of research to pick a place, a setting, to place this story that I had in mind. And I learned about this city in southeastern Poland, which was also the Ukraine and the Soviet Union and changed hands, that had this rich musical tradition, which was very unusual for that part of the world, that was rich in arts and music and culture and not so much the politics. It was really about artists coming together, and actually similar to Chapel Hill and to other communities around here that are rich in education and arts, and that's the beauty. And people flocked to this place and made music for centuries in this place.
A real cultural center and a kind of mixmaster, as you say. It's a city that went back and forth between Ukraine and Poland, but even before that, this is a place of great mixing, right,
mm-hmm.
culturally.
Exactly.
So you learn about this place, and then, of course, the tragedy that happened there, as it did in other cities, although it seemed to be much quicker in that city,
exactly.
Partly because it wasn't prepared politically or militarily, right?
Right. And, you know, of course, the Holocaust was carried out in so many different ways, depending on where it was geographically, when it was in the war, the size of the city, and the way it played out in Ravno was very quick. The Wehrmacht, the German army, came in. It was followed by the Einsatzgruppen, which were the mobile killing units, whose job it was to wipe out Jewish communities as they were taken over. And so the massacre was a 2-day massacre in 1941, where just about every Jewish resident of Ravno was killed at that time.
That information may have been readily available, but then from then on, it was a pretty tough ordeal for you. Tell us about the research that went into this.
Well, I spent a lot of time looking for a survivor from Ravno, which I thought was going to be a lot easier. I found some memoirs, I found some letters, but even after putting out ads, speaking to people, putting out the word, to try to find even one person to help me resurrect this city, I couldn't find anyone. And I almost stepped away and put away the project because I was so disheartened by not being able to find a single person. One day I was sitting with my grandma in Brooklyn, in her apartment in Brooklyn, and I said, "Grandma, you know, Grandpa I know came from this place in Poland, which was in another part of Poland. But, you know, I'm working on this book and I'm looking for someone who's from Ravno. Does that ring a bell?" And she said, "Yeah, my friend Pearl, who lives over there, is from Rovno. And of course, you know, in Brooklyn over there, you could point out the window and 60,000 people away, there's, you know, over there. And thus began this extraordinary experience of interviewing Pearl Sapoznik, who shared her remarkable story with me of growing up in Rovno and reconstructing for me everything from the cobblestone pathways to the smells of and sense of the bakeries and just the minutia of all of this wonderful city that had been destroyed. And I remember sitting down with her and her saying, the first thing she said to me is, there are stories and there are stories. And what I tell you are stories. And then she took out this photo album of hundreds of faces of her family members. And she went through the photo album and one by one said, killed in the Holocaust, killed in the Holocaust, killed in the Holocaust. And that was my introduction to this other world that I realized I understood such a tiny fraction of. And Pearl helped me to bring the city back to life.
You're going
to
have to help me, though, understand. How did you interpret her version of the stories? Which stories was she telling you?
The stories of real people. And I think she was very aware of the fact that when we reflect now on the events of the Holocaust, that it seems two-dimensional. That we know that we hear a lot of numbers, we hear quantities of this number of people killed and this geographical place was wiped out. But it's hard to stop and think about these people with lives and dreams and hopes and worlds and lives just as we do today.
It's interesting for me to think about the process of this book for you, because it seems that you had an idea, a concept, this idea of art in the midst of this chaos and horror, what it can do, and what we as individuals, as the artists, can bring to it. And now you have the real story. What did that do to you to hear actual stories, the minutiae, the smells, the sights?
It was interesting. Once I got started, everything seemed to happen very quickly, and it was such a powerful experience to feel that I was really building this world brick by brick, and in a way feeling that I had this information that possibly no one else really had. To have this combination of this information about this lost community and also the desire to write about it and to put it together. And to bring these puzzle pieces together. So I felt I was deeply moved many times, and it felt very quick and exciting, and I felt that I really was doing something good, I hope, to honor these people.
Tell us about the structure of the book. You have interviews, and then there's a narrative. So tell us how it's set up.
You know, it's interesting. I had this highly ambitious goal, I think, to have the experience of reading the book mirror, in some ways, the experience of listening to music. So you've got these independent movements, so to speak, that fit together, but exist independently, but yet have recurring themes and patterns and interludes and intermezzos and end in a crescendo. And I imagine that it would be sort of like the experience of listening to music and having the experience of reading the book be musical in a way. And without giving away too much, it mirrors the what's going on in the story as the novel or musical experience, if you will, proceeds.
A main character named Aaron. Tell us about him.
Aaron is at the beginning of the book, he's a young man who inherits this strange family heirloom, which is this ancient harp called a kinnor, which is mentioned in the Bible a few times. We're not exactly sure what it was, what it sounded like. King David is said to have played it. And he inherits this strange heirloom, and he connects with it. And he falls in love with this instrument and goes on to play it and master it. And it goes on to shape who he is and the choices he makes. And he, in understanding this passion he has and this gift he has, he makes these very difficult choices, as we all do in life, and Do I choose between something that's going to be safe? Do I take a risk? Do I do something that will make my family happy or something that will help me follow my bliss? And all of these great questions that I like to think we all face. So he's a traveler, he's a musician, and I hope a teacher.
Will you read for us?
Sure. This first selection is from the beginning of the book, at the just around the time when Aaron receives this kinnor and he's fallen in love with the instrument. Aaron practiced constantly. In his sleep, he heard permutations of notes and chords that had not occurred to him during the day, intricate webbed patterns of sound that he would knead into the kinnor upon waking. At school, he thought of nothing but music. Arithmetic was its structure, reading was its rhythm, history its memory. His classmates thought him odd, too serious and too old for his age. His teachers thought him aloof but too studious to correct. All regarded him with curiosity. By the end of the school day, it was a question of how many minutes, how many seconds, until he can play again. He would envision himself racing across the cobblestones of Shishego Maya, bursting into the bakery, kissing his father's flour-dusted cheek, running upstairs, embracing his mother, promising that he would play for only 1 hour before turning to his homework, and then, finally, the kinnor. And every time he would place the instrument between his knees and bring his fingertips across the strings, the chords would be more crisp, the passing notes more subtle, the strings at rest more still.
Scott Blumenthal reading from his debut novel, The Kiss. Sound plays a very important part in this, as you say, constructed almost as a musical piece in many ways. And yet light, it seems to me, is also a very important element in this novel.
Yeah. There's, you know, to me, the greatest stories were always this idea of a small light at a time of great darkness, from biblical stories of Moses and the Nile all the way through Star Wars. To me, most powerful stories were about this tiny light that pierces the darkness and affects the world in some way. And it's a symbol that you see in Judaism, in Christianity, in all the great world religions, this idea of light piercing darkness and changing people.
Scott Blumenthal is my guest. The novel is called The Kiss, and you're listening to The State of Things. Talking about this debut novel that won the Ippy Gold Medal for Historical Fiction this year. So let's stay with this theme of light, because it's an interesting one, particularly the light and the darkness. If you look out in the cosmos, it looks pretty dark to us with our weak eyes, but in fact, light is passing through it. And you talk about the transformative quality of these instruments, this music that you can't wait to get back to play and to practice, and the effect of these little sort of particles of light even between ourselves transforming us. But under duress, right? And so also in the novel are these interviews with people. Many of them are cynical about these possibilities for hope in the face of despair. All kinds of philosophical ideas that confront a disaster like the Shoah or the Holocaust. As you went from the concept of the novel, hope is and meaning are possible through art, to the gritty details of the people annihilated in this horrific massacre, did you start changing? Did you become cynical? Did you lose faith at any point in this?
I was, yeah. You know, I think I was part of that dance between hope and cynicism many times. As I think many of us who study the Holocaust and many readers in general who delve into literature and ask the big questions, is does this all make sense? Is at the end of the day, is there reason, is there meaning to this all? And I think the light was the answer that said yes, it does at the end of the day. And even as things got extremely dark, there was this light that said there is hope and there is something to look to. And of course, when it's dark, you look to those lights, and the metaphor of the cosmos is you see those pinpoints of light, and that's what you see.
See them, but again, it doesn't in many ways. And I think what's beautiful about the book is that again, if we look into the dark night, the dark sky at night, it looks dark to us. It looks, and yet we know light is passing through it, and so. to underscore, I think, the role of the artist or the mystic to aggregate that light, to collect it within them, and then have the courage under every circumstance to project that sort of collection that they've brought together. If it's if our eyes are too weak to sense that light that's passing through the darkness, aren't we lucky to have those among us who can pull it together and then project a story? How much did this change your historical knowledge of the Shoah, the Holocaust, as you did the research?
Oh, dramatically. And I'll answer it in a slightly roundabout way. When even in the early days of the killing of Jews and so many other groups, the what was happening was referred to as the Holocaust. But many writers and historians and survivors began to quickly question whether that was a misnomer. The word Holocaust comes from the Greek helokauston, which is a burnt offering, a sacrifice to God, and has been used for mass killings for a long time. But a lot of people said, you know what, it wasn't. It wasn't a sacrifice. It wasn't this thing that we're offering to God. Mm. It was instead this destruction, which is the Hebrew word Shoah, which doesn't have this sort of spiritual resonance to it. And my journey in understanding that period was similar, that I went from wanting to wrap my mind around it and understand it and make sense of it and have it somehow come together in a way that I can understand and look at, looking at the history, looking at the psychology, and realizing that, in fact, it didn't make sense, and stepping away and realizing it and understanding it for what it was.
It's a wonderful book, Scott. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Scott Blumenthal is talking about his debut novel, The Kiss. He's going to be reading from his work tomorrow, 7 o'clock, Barnes & Noble in Durham. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, Will Michaels, our intern Charlie Shelton, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf is the news director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio.